Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor and improv comedy legend, Matt Walsh. Despite my disastrous high school brush with improv comedy, it's never lost its magic for me. It's such a deceptively simple art. And in this episode, I talk to one of its masters. Matt Walsh is one of the four co-founders of Upright Citizens Brigade, the world's most famous sketch and improv theater. In launching UCB, Matt, along with Amy Poehler, Ian Roberts, and Matt Besser, are responsible for launching improv's rise to popularity and, indirectly, the careers of comedians like Aziz Ansari, Kate McKinnon, and Ed Helms. Like most kids, Walsh loved jokes. Unlike most kids, he was compelled to take them apart to see what made them funny. He attended college and made a valiant effort in his dad's heavy machinery business, but knew he'd never have a straight job, even if it meant being broke in New York at age 30, hoping to get a UCB sketch show on TV. These days, Matt's on TV playing press secretary Mike McClintock on Veep, one of my favorite shows on television. But nothing will ever match the challenge and freedom of working a stage without a net. That's why, if you're lucky, you can still catch him on one of his regular UCB drop-ins. Insider tip, try the Sunday night ASCAT show in Los Angeles. You might just get lucky. Matt joined me to talk about his very first sketch, the do's and don'ts of comedy, and the agony and ecstasy of directing improv films. Then, in the middle of it, someone showed up with alternative facts about his childhood. Well, in improv, you have to expect the unexpected. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Sam.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Good morning.
Thank you for doing this.
I love getting out to Santa Monica. See a little water, see a little ocean.
Yeah.
It's good.
Well, I was thinking just as we were talking right before that happened that this show is kind of
right before you said hi?
No, right before the slate.
Oh, sorry.
I was thinking that this show is kind of my version of improv where I don't know where it's going to go. I don't know exactly what we're going to talk about. Even if I know what I'm going to say, I don't know what you're going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I always get a little bit of nerves right as that slate comes in. Oh. I get a little like...
That's good, though.
Not stage fright, not butterflies, but just a little like, a little tight.
That's good, though. That's what drives you to like, it raises your adrenaline and it gets you to like focus a little more, I think. That's good.
Do you still get that?
Well, not with improv shows. So a tiny bit. Like scripted things are more stressful for me, but if I'm doing an improv show... And I know the cast and like their friends, and I know they're super funny. I don't have any nerves, or if it's at home at UCB stage. But if I'm doing an improv show with people I don't know, or some people I don't know, or a stage I'm not familiar with, then I do get nervous because I don't want to ruin the show.
It's so funny to hear you say that you have more stress on a scripted situation.
A little bit, just because you're expected to deliver, you know, there's quantifiable beats that you have to hit. Whereas improv is very forgiving, and it's just like, well, there's no script, so there's going to be mistakes. Like, you kind of own that failure can happen.
Yeah. Well, I guess if there was anyone that was going to be comfortable in an improv situation, it would be you. I mean, you guys, you, Amy Poehler, Matt Besser, and Ian Roberts started
Correct.
Upright Citizens Brigade. How many years ago now? Like 27 years ago?
Early 90s, technically, we all kind of started
okay.
doing it. Started in Chicago, and then we got our first theater in New York in 1998. Like, we opened our first theater in 98. But we were a group in the early 90s, knocking around Chicago and like a Thai restaurant or a basement cafe and getting kicked out for bringing beer in or serving the audience liquor. Or I remember one show we did in Austin where we gave whippets to some people on stage. It's like, what are we? And the owner was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're insane. You can't do that. And we were like, yeah, you're right.
Did you see yourself as avant-garde artists or as misfits?
I think we wanted to believe that we were avant-garde or that we were edgy. Like, we had a lot of anger or unbridled energy. So a lot of the stuff we did in Chicago was like pranks, like Besser dressed like the Unabomber and delivered a package at the post office and we kind of, you know, filmed it. And we did a lot of pranks in Chicago. So our aggressive comedy was what we liked to do. I remember I did one thing, which was a terrible bit, in a stage show where I came out and said, could someone please move their car, license plate, blah, blah, blah. There's an ambulance trying to get in the parking lot. Somebody's had a heart attack. I came out 20 minutes later. whoever's in this room that owns a car, please, the ambulance can't get in the parking lot. You need to move your car. And then at the end, I said, oh, the guy died. Thanks a lot. But like people, like, what do you think? How do you, as a writer or performer, how do you think that's going to be funny ever? It was funny to us. But in retrospect, if you're an innocent person, like, it's not my car. And then you think, oh, my God, someone died because some jerk wouldn't move their car. There's no payoff to that bit. It's just sort of a angry, in-your-face kind of, I don't know. So we did a lot of things. There was one sketch where we had a bet between me and Besser, supposedly, and I lost the bet. So I had to eat a can of dog food on stage. But it was just corned beef hash, but completely looks like dog food.
Sure.
So you're watching a performer in a sketch show eat what you think is dog food, and it's not a good ride for the audience. So we had a lot of not refined ideas, like close to being funny, but not quite. The rough edges weren't cut off them yet, or they didn't have the payoff that we ultimately learned to do later in our careers.
See, I wish you were around when I was growing up, because you and I share that thing of using the unsuspecting public as fodder for our own amusement.
There's a certain amount of, I'm sure, unfocused anger at the root of all those things. Do you know what I mean? Like you're sort of restless. Because I totally, like, I remember seeing a TV show, it might have been Welcome Back, Kotter, where one of the characters on the show had like a dollar bill with like a fish line on it, and they put it in the hallway and people would stop to pick it up and they would pull the dollar bill away.
Yeah.
At that time, that was perfectly in line with my sense of humor. Like just sort of pranking someone was really funny to me.
But it's funny, because those are the sort of the building blocks of improv in a way, wanting to see how experiments work in real time with no safety net. That is sort of like the process of improv in a way.
You're right, there's no script and there's no, you have an idea of what you want to convince someone of, but you don't know the beats to get there because you don't know their response. You don't know, like, the shills, the real person's response. You don't know what they're going to say, and you don't know what you're going to have to come up with to convince them. Correct.
Yeah.
It is all in keeping with improv. I was just thinking of, we used to just in Chicago would pull over or sit on a stoop and tell people you can't go this way. There's a gas leak. You got to go back that way, go around. Like, out of boredom.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear of Coyle and Sharp?
No.
They were early, pre-candid camera, two guys in San Francisco who did these insane audio pranks. They were the four, you know, forefathers of kind of what, you know, Candid Camera and what UCB did, you know. They did amazing stuff. They would go and try to convince people if what we'd like to do is surgically implant a quarter in your head every year, and in 10 years we'll give you $500. And people like, so wait, let me try to understand this. They're going to put a new quarter every year into my brain, and then at the end of it, I get $500. And we're like, yeah. That's what we're trying. But these guys would, they had such good verbal acumen, and there was two of them. One would play the straight, one would play, like, I don't know if that's a good idea. But they were really great.
That's funny, because in the beginning of your UCB textbook that you wrote,
yeah,
there's an example of a script where there's a dentist that's got to pull a tooth, but he's going to anesthetize the patient with a brick.
Yes.
And that, to me, reminds me of that, of the idea is defined in this unusual thing, a straight man or enough of a grounded in reality actor that can sort of make a decent case for anesthetizing you with
yes.
a brick.
Yes. That's what pranks are, absolutely. You're trying to build a logical argument if you're convincing someone of something absurd, or if you're playing a reality that's completely absurd. Like, I did a show called Dog Bites Man.
Yeah.
It was basically Ali G guys, this guy Dan Mazur. We were a fake news team, so I played a pompous news anchor from Spokane, Washington, and then Andrea Savage was like the producer, Zach Galifianakis was like the director, and 80 Miles was like the intern, basically. And we would just go into unwitting locations, and all four of us would commit to this absurd reality, and our job was to like keep it going as long as possible. Like, and that was the show. I mean, ultimately, it was awful because you get tired of kind of being mean or being rude to nice people.
Yeah.
So you sell your soul when you do those things.
Even it has a different effect when you're older than when
you're
younger.
Yeah, when you're younger. And it was like one of the first shows I was on, so I was hungry to make something funny, and the cast was great, and but by the end of that show, we all just started writing things that didn't involve the public, because we were all like, I can't do this anymore. I can't, like,
right.
You know, because we did one thing in Oregon where we were like, clean up a highway. So we got this crew these like nice, let's say a parent-teacher group from Oregon, met us on a highway. I came out. They were always, the joke for my character was always like, he's like Brian Williams. You're gonna recognize him instantly. You're gonna recognize, and I would come out and nobody knew. My job was to have a really big ego and pretend people should know me. Long story short, we show up, the director, Zach, Miles, we all show up and we look at the highway shoulder and we're like, there's not enough garbage. We need more garbage. So then we proceeded to dump a ton more garbage on the shoulder of this real highway. And then I just jump. I of course don't come out the last minute. I come out and like, I say something like, I'm Kevin Beacon and we're cleaning up this highway with these lovely people here in Oregon. Okay, that's right. We all got in the van and just left the garbage and drove away. And our cameras were watching these people like, I can't believe they just left all this. It's terrible. It's terrible.
But totally my sense of humor.
Yeah.
And would they stay and clean it up?
No, then eventually, you know, once they got the footage of these people sort of like, those mother blankers, they just left all, like, they would turn on you, of course.
Right.
Then once they got their footage, our show got the footage, then some production or art department would come back and clean it up. You know what I mean?
Well, it brings up a thought about improv to me, which is that eventually who you really are is going to come out.
Yeah.
Like when you're in a troupe and every night you're trying things and you're failing and you don't have time to think. I mean, even at the beginning of your book, it says something that I think applies to life as much as it does to improv, which is, if you're hesitating, you're planning, you're not improvising.
Ultimately, I think your point is like, you are enough. You don't have to put on a show or develop tons more knowledge or fake anything. Like if you're in a scene, in an improv scene on stage, you have plenty of information in your brain and you have plenty of life experience. So just use that and respond how you would respond. If you held a gun to my head, then what would I do? I would go, I'll give you anything. Like, that's what Matt Walsh would do. Like, I don't want to die. That's right. All you need. Like, ultimately, you don't need to be a trained actor or a Shakespearean actor. Just embody as well as you can this imaginary circumstance and just behave as if you were in it. So there's enough. Basically, I think it's about, like, coming to terms with, like, oh, I know enough or I can handle any situation because I can revert back to how I would behave in that situation. If you're doing monologues, those are very forthcoming and you bare your soul more and they're more truthful in a way about your personal experience. When you're doing improv scenes, you might cull information or experience or you might have involuntary reactions, but it's not like revealing some embarrassing sexual anecdote necessarily. That's not necessarily going to come up in improv, but it could very much come up in the monologue sort of form, if that makes sense.
Did you ever have a day on stage where you just ended up so low after the experience, like dressed down or either from a failure or from the way you were treated where it made you feel like, why am I doing this?
Yeah, I've had plenty of them. I'm trying to think of, like, it's usually, you can sort of hedge your bets by putting a cast of funny people around you. Like, the great thing about improv, it's ensemble based. So if you have basically all stars around you, you're not burdened with, like, I got to carry the show ever. It's just like, I can come up with half an idea or an interesting thought or tell an interesting monologue, and these champions, these guys who are amazing, these people, will make it work. Like, you just have that trust and that training to, like, run with it. So that's the beauty of improv. So generally, it doesn't fail if you're with a good group of people.
Right.
But I've, you know, venue specific, sometimes you do shows where there's no lavalier mics, so you're holding handheld mics and you're trying to do scenes. Or we did a show at like a jam festival out in Connecticut, and it was like people wasted and high on their way to their campgrounds, and we were trying to hold their attention after they just saw kick-ass rock and roll. And like, comedy never competes with rock and roll. Like, it can open for rock and roll, but you can't follow rock and roll. So there are moments where it was just like a nightmare. Like, I will never do this again. But they're sort of situation specific,
yeah. You know.
But in my experience, if you're trying to be funny, that's where you get in trouble. If you're really like, oh, I'm going to come up with a killer line or I'm going to be the funniest one in this show, like, those are the things that will just destroy you on stage. But if you're sort of modest in your approach, like, I'm just going to commit to this reality and I'm going to listen, then you have success. Like, it's like the audience will go with you through those moments, like, ooh, this is a little wonky. I don't know if this is going to turn out well. And then, lo and behold, somebody in the back line or yourself will come out and have it all make sense or have a funny take on what just happened.
Right.
So the trick, I think, with improv is like, just play it real. And it's, I sound like I'm in teaching mode, but it's really about listening. It's really about listening. It's about relinquishing your idea about what the scene's about or what the funny idea, I'm going to have a home run joke here. And you got to let that go and dial into what that guy's saying, what your scene partner's saying.
Right.
As well as like the unconscious things of like the emotion you're getting from them or their posture or their character. And then you draw on your life experience as if this scene is really happening.
How do you stay out of your own head?
It's hard. It is a battle because you're like, you can't say things that are like off color, like, oh boy, they didn't like that one. But you can also, in an improv show, you can address the audience and say, oh, come on, is that really over the line? Like, you can talk to the audience like a stand-up mic, and you can go, that is not that offensive, you guys. You're being way too sensitive. You know, so there, it's very fluid, and anything kind of goes. So I don't know. I guess, but I think the trick is truthfully, like, to have a bit of faith in the group you're performing with, and then really just try to, like, not go out there guns a-blazing to be the funniest or to be super funny. Like, just do the fundamentals. Like, just play it real. Just listen. Support the ideas that you're getting from the other people on stage. If somebody's like, I wish that waiter would be here, jump on it. Don't hesitate. Come on stage. Be a waiter. Don't be in your head going, I know they want a waiter, but I don't have a good waiter character. It's like, no, fuck it. Just get out there. Like, free yourself from, like, having it be perfect or super funny. Just support, yes and, listen, trusting your partner, making them the most important thing of the scene, and then respecting the audience, like giving them the benefit of the doubt that they're, many of them are smarter than you. They're here to have a good night, so don't feel like, oh, I gotta craft something that they're gonna understand and they're gonna, it's like, no, they're here. They probably like us already, or they're intelligent people, so let's go for the funniest, smartest thing we can do and roll the dice that way.
Well, you know, you can watch an improv show and you can sort of see the calculating going on and on all the work that people don't ever know is going on. It's going
right
on. Like, you're trying to communicate without using words to each other.
The best compliment is always like, are you sure that wasn't written?
Right.
Like, if it's seamless right and nothing feels like, oh my God, they're totally in a corner here. They don't know what's going to, how they're going to get out of this. If it just feels like, because the mistakes are part of it too. Like, you, Del Close, who's like referenced in the book, was always like, he was big on like, look for those mistakes, those moments that like nobody expects and go towards them. Like, don't go, all right, we gotta brush that off stage. That was not supposed to happen. Like, no, you can address that, explore it, see if there's something interesting there, because sometimes those are gifts. A lot of times those are gifts.
What do you really love about improv? Like, what's the carrot for you that keeps you coming back to it?
I treat improv like a gym night for me. Like, I do a show two or three times a month. I'll just show up at ASCAT, which is our show that's been running for 20 years or whatever. And it's like pickup basketball. It keeps me in shape. I always have a huge laugh. I get to see friends that I don't get to see during the week. It's literally like exercise for my improv muscle. And that's what I love most about it. And then while I'm in it, it's very simply, it's like great laughs. Like, you get great laughs, or you get into these like amazing, weird scenes that you couldn't have written because you're collaborating with people who think completely different than you.
Right.
And it's challenging because it's like, oh my God, how can we keep this going? Like, or someone pimps you into being like, I'll bring in my Russian doctor, and then all of a sudden you're coming through the door and you have to be a Russian doctor. Those sort of challenges are fun. They're a little terrifying because, like, I don't do a good Russian accent, but also they're a lesson in, like, well, fuck it, I'll just commit to my best Russian accent and I'll be the Russian doctor.
Yeah, what do you think you get out of challenging yourself? Like, at this age and at this point in your career, does it, like, is there a part of it that's just that you like the process even more than the finished result? I mean, does that define you?
Yeah, I do, and certainly in improv, I really do like the process. I like the way it gets made, and I like the people you get to play with. I don't know if that's a good answer, but yeah, I mean, for me, the challenge, having done improv for so long, is just, I don't want to go to a show or do a scene and feel like, oh my God, I did that character again. Like, my go-to, everybody has strengths. As a performer, I can be a good straight man, or I can be broad and wacky. I probably tend to be more straight. But I do like moments where I get to be broad and silly, or where I'm forced to dance, because I think that stretches you, or sing, God forbid I'm a terrible singer. Like, whatever those things are, I like that it gets me off my comfort zone. It gets me out of my comfort zone. And that's what I like about improv, is like, I don't want to do another scene where I feel like, oh my God, I've done this scene again, or I'm playing this guy again.
Yeah, yeah.
I can do it, and I inevitably do it the majority of the time because that's who I am, and those are my strengths. But I do like those moments where I'm like, I haven't done that ever, maybe. Like, that's what's cool about it. I've never done a scene like that, or that character was really fun to do. I don't think I've done anything like that. That's what's really fun, when you discover those moments. You're sort of chasing that small innovation in your repertoire, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I hear you saying that it also keeps you young in a way.
It does keep me young.
Yeah.
And we always talk to the audience at the beginning, and those people are like 25. Average age is 25. I'm 52. So we grill them on, like, what's pop culture for you? Like, I literally find out what the kids are into, and I also want, you know, to find out where that generation gap is. Like, we quiz them, we ask questions like how many people voted or who has a marijuana weed card. So we also do it profiling to see how many people don't have cable. Like, all these things that, because the new generation is
right.
different, I want to know where that gap is. I want to know, like, how are they different from me, and how are they different from what I assume they're like. Like, a lot of times, there was one time a girl didn't know who Bruce Springsteen was. Literally an 18-year-old girl.
Right.
Just was on YouTube all day going down wormholes of her niche passion, which could have been anime or something. I forget what she was into. And I was like, you do not know who Bruce Springsteen is. And I don't think she was lying. She really didn't know. But that's okay, because he won't live forever. But he was so meaningful to our generation, or
yeah.
certainly ever present. Maybe you're not a huge fan, but you know who Springsteen is. You know what I mean? And that's what's really interesting
to
me.
That's the gap.
Yeah, that's the gap. Exactly yeah. right. We play a game called Stump the Old Man. So if you can come up with like a song lyric or a show title or a character from a sitcom or any cultural reference that half the people in the audience know and me and like Besser don't know, you win and you get a free T-shirt.
Is that getting harder to win for you guys?
Yeah. Well, as we get older, probably we are losing our relevance. But it can't be like, okay, what's the name of my dog from grammar school? Because
right.
nobody in the room would know that. So you're trying to profile like, okay, on average, half the people here know what she's talking about. All right, then we're old men. Like, you've proven it. We're old men. And sometimes I'm like striding like the old man. Like, you should read that book. Like, if you haven't read Catcher in the Rye would be the example. Like,
yeah.
And someone's like, that's a dumb book. I have no problem saying, you should read that book. You're fucking 20 years old. That's a rite of passage. Read the book. Like, I have no problem clinging to my old-fashioned thinking on some things.
Well, you've got to. I mean,
yeah.
we're the elders
yeah.
now, right?
Exactly.
There's a responsibility to pass on things like that.
Yeah.
I would worry if I were in your position that people come down on an improv show and then you show up and the expectation that your stuff is going to be funnier and more elevated, like, this is the guy, you guys, this is the guy, you know? He's
yeah.
the one who basically started this whole thing, so
yeah.
now we're in for a great show.
Well, I just did a show in New York at the ASCAT in New York, which is like where it started, and I showed up for the Sunday Night Late Show, the free show, which has been running for 20 years, but nobody in the cast was somebody I really knew. It was all like 30-year-old people, super funny, super talented UCB people. And I felt like, oh, I don't want to ruin the show. Like So that one made me nervous a little bit, because I know that I'm in my theater and people like, oh, that's Walsh. He's starting, you know, he's one of the guys who started it. But I just wanted to do a fuck around ASCAT show.
But you can't, right? In some ways.
You can't. You can once you get over, like, you know, when I come out, I'm going to get a good applause.
Right.
But ultimately, all you want to do is just, like, do a good show. And, like, and it did work out, but I was sort of nervous, and it was sort of, like, definitely out of my comfort zone. Like, if I play in L.A., I know everybody in the cast.
Right.
And they're not necessarily my age, but we can all play great together, you know. But in New York, it was like, this is good. I don't play with these guys, and it's all the same rules. And it was a challenge. And
I imagine it would be scary for them, too.
Well, that's the other thing, is I don't want it to be scary. Yeah, I guess in their shoes, if somebody they never met but is supposedly a legend in this improv world, and then you do a show with them, I guess they might be a little nervous or a little respectful or something, and they don't want to, like, enter a scene that I'm doing or something like that. But once you get going, it all goes out the window. It's just like, So it's like music. You just start jamming. And
but it is funny that that awareness that comes along, kind of almost like a wash of embarrassment or something, when you look around, you realize that you as a person, I know I feel this way, don't feel any older inside.
No.
Like, is that happening to you sometimes where you're sort of hit with that awareness mid whatever?
I went to Walgreens and bought something, and the kid gave me the senior discount. And I was like, I took it. Don't get me wrong. I took the discount.
Of course you did.
But he just told me, punch it up. I was like, I'll give you the senior discount. And I'm like, in that moment, I'm like, oh, you see me as an old man. Like, I appear, my avatar is older. I get it. But I don't think that way. Like,
in your head, you're like, I better bring my ID in case I get carded.
I don't have that delusion anymore. But it was funny. Yeah. I'm like, do you want the ID? And I'm like, you don't need an ID? He's like, no, you're fine. Like,
that's clearly old.
Yeah. So there are moments that like, oh yeah, I'm an old, but you think the same way. You absolutely think the same way as you did when you're 20.
It is strange how much appearances and status and position make us have a bias in any conversation we have.
Yeah. When we have actors on Veep, for example, like Martin Mull or Brian Doyle Murray, these guys that are comedy, you know, lore, they're legends, they're amazing, and they don't want you to worship them. They just want to make a good comedy scene. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
They're like, fuck that stuff. Like, I hate that. Like, and they're nervous too. Once you start to like work with them and stuff like that, they're like just actors like you. And ultimately, all that sort of legend or over respect inhibits like getting gritty and making a good comedy scene. So that it's interesting to see people who come on our show, Veep, who I have, Hugh Laurie, whoever they are.
Sure.
Like, super funny people that I've watched for years and worship in a way. They just want to get past that so we can get to work and make a good show. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and there's no manual for how to do it either, because you're going to have the preconceived notions or feelings toward that person when they come in.
Yeah.
And they've got their own thing. And
for me, like, I want the 20-year-olds to treat me like the same age, but ultimately that gap might be too big.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to talk to you about improv movies. You've directed two of them,
mm-hmm.
High Road and A Better You.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched both these films and...
Thank you.
I feel like, first thing is, if I didn't know they were improv, I wouldn't, especially like watching High Road, I just felt like I was watching an independent film that was well plotted and had beats. But it brings up a question as to what you think an improv film can do that a scripted film can't. Or is it back to you just love the process so much that you want to be surprised?
I do love the process. Selfishly, I love the discovery that happens on camera. Like, you're filming it and then they discover things. And there's a couple reasons I like it. One is, if you write characters in a comedy or whatever, it's really difficult to, like, say, Woody Allen, all his characters sort of talk like Woody Allen, or Aaron Sorkin, all his characters sort of talk like Aaron Sorkin, if you will. What an improvised movie is, like, hopefully you do have a good structure, but you have whoever, Zach Woods or Rob Riggle or Joe Latrulio or Brian Husky, their ability to, like, okay, now you can, this is what has to happen in the scene, but say it however you want. They completely create a character in a dialogue pattern that you would never come up with. That's what I think is unique about improv, is the variance and the
variance vibrant, of voice.
Yeah, the variance of voice and delivery and concept. Like, you should have a good, like, in a good outline. Like, we do outline them, like, 45 pages or whatever, of 45 scenes or 60 scenes. You probably have 20 pages of outline in each, two paragraphs beneath each scene of, like, here's what's funny, here's who's coming in, here's the props we're going to need. Like, it's not, all right, just go fuck around. Rolling, you know.
Right.
It is, and you want the emotional arc to happen, and you want this sort of resolution. But as far as, like, the specific dialogue, I love rehearsing it, and then you film it, and then I love that stuff. I love the real variance, and I think the true discoveries that you come up with on set.
I would think there would be a budget question there, too,
yeah.
Because it seems like if you were trying to do that and you had such a tight, tiny budget, you'd have to make peace with a lot of things where you found it once and you're like, well, we got it. We should really move on.
Yeah.
Versus, wow, we really found something there. Let's discover it.
Ultimately, you don't get the luxury. Yeah, well, the first movie was like $300,000. The second movie was like $100,000. Like, there are sort of art projects. You know, it's not, you're not, you don't have department heads and things to like really give yourself the opportunity to play. So you try to encourage people to improvise on story. But ultimately, the hardest thing about directing for me, you can relate, is like that weight of production, I feel like ages me. Like you have someone in your, like, we have three locations today, and you're fucking around with this dumb bit at the door.
And that's the art of it, right?
It is. It's like knowing when to ignore that, but you also want to serve production because you can't be just indulging things that aren't going to get used, and you feel, you know, the producers are sweating it, and you're like, all right, okay, that's good, we got it. Like, that is what's the balance of directing, is like knowing.
You're always robbing from someplace.
Yeah, it's very stressful. Like, you're a director. It's very stressful to, like, if the gun's not working or if you got a reset, we only get to break one plate and you already broke it on the first take, and you know that take's not the one. You have to rewrite on this. All right, the scene's not about the plate anymore. Give me a second. Like, you just have to be willing to, like, whole cloth change something, but also not lose track and not get stressed out by the production schedule at the end of the day, like, hoping to God you got it. Because in the edit, that's fun, as you know. You can, like, fix a lot and see. And at the end of the day, you're like, I made two jokes better. You know it. You see the progress. But when you're filming, sometimes you're like, oh, God, I hope we got it.
Yeah.
Because we got to go.
You mentioned Woody Allen and the singular voice that comes through all the characters. And that's the downfall of having only one voice. But at the same time, I would think that you could finish directing an improv movie and feel like, this isn't totally my voice.
You cling to the story. Like, at the end of the day, you want to make sure that the emotional truth of the story is represented. If the bits are, like, too raunchy or too stupid with the tone you're shooting for, then you know that as a director. You're like, I won't use that. And you have no problem telling actors that. It's like, that's funny, but it's a little broad for what we're trying to get at here. Give me something a little over here. Or that whole riff is really funny. Might be an extra on the DVD, but we got to stay focused on, like...
You have to be the fun spoiler sometimes.
But they're actors. Like, they...
Right.
They get it. Like, they're like, yeah, you're right. Yeah. You know, they have no ego about it. But you are just making sure you get the story is the shortest answer. Like, just make sure the emotional truth that you wanted when you sort of outlined it and the story and the tone are consistent, you know, with what you're shooting for.
Right. You know, it brings the question up of what kind of mind do you have? You know, and as a kid, like, did you have dreams of being a comedian or a director?
I think I have a good comedy mind. I think I've always, like, as a little kid, I always knew jokes. The minute somebody told me a joke, I remembered it. I just had a natural inclination to remember comedy and jokes. Like, if street jokes, they call them. Like, if somebody started, I know it. Like, when I was a young kid, I know that one.
How do you get a nun pregnant?
I know it. There's two different punchlines, you know. It wasn't like I studied in a book. They were just street jokes. But they always stayed with me. I always cared about it, probably,
more than anything. Were you able to see the structure of a joke and see how it related to another joke? Because I think that's a very specific talent, to be able to understand how it worked and apply a different scenario to it to make your own joke.
Yeah. And you want it to be surprising. Like, good jokes are surprising. They're probably traditional in form, but they have a better punchline or a more interesting setup. They're still traditional. I think I understood that it's like the young people loved SNL because it was different, but ultimately underneath it, there's still setup and punchline and character that Sid Caesar did or the Marx Brothers did. It's all there, or Peter Sellers, it's all there, but somehow it was refreshed, or the subject matter perhaps was more relevant too. They were sort of, I read somewhere, like Lampoon was sort of unpacking the Eisenhower era. Nobody had sort of, when National Lampoon came along, nobody had sort of gone to the attic of American values, which was the Eisenhower boom of, you know, whatever, all that goodness that America was living in.
Yeah.
They were the first generation that got to, like, tear it down, like Boy Scouts and, like, whatever, you know, all those things. So you want to attack, hopefully, those things that you as a person find hypocritical or not true but are accepted as true. I think you learn that as a comedian. And also you want to surprise people with the ways you deliver it. You don't want to do it in, like, the same way that everyone else has. So I think I have a sense or a hunger to do that. You know,
sometimes. And what age did you start, like, taking that apart.
The first thing I did was a variety show in high school. The first performing, yeah. That was like when I got bit by the bug. I got to be, me and my buddies wrote sketches that made fun of the teachers. And
did you want it to be like Saturday Night Live?
Or? Yeah, I think unconsciously we were definitely trying to be Saturday Night Live. I don't know that we said it. And then we were a success. We were like the hit of the variety show in Hinsdale South. And I really liked that. I liked writing it, and I liked the reaction of the audience. It's very powerful and very fun to create something and then get to show it to an audience and have it succeed.
Who were you in your group of friends? You know, were you the instigator, the organizer? Were you the idea generator?
I wasn't the organizer, no.
You weren't?
I wasn't the organizer, no. I'm an instigator. I'm sort of like... Like, I wore, like, pajama shirts in college, like, whatever that guy, and bowling shoes. Like, I didn't, I would thumb my nose at convention just to sort of push against something without knowing what I was doing.
You distrusted all forms of authoritative...
In a way, like, my mom's here. She's I have a great relationship with my family. I wasn't, like, came from an awful home, but I always had this, like, I don't know, like... push to try something different than what was accepted, if that makes sense. I don't know what that is, but my parents, you know, had
I'm
a...
full of it.
I'm full
don't
of what?
Don't believe anything he says.
This is my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a hard time.
How do you do?
Nice to meet you.
Audrey.
Yeah.
It's hard to be the middle kid. I didn't get a lot of attention.
It's not as bad as being the eldest.
Why is the oldest worse?
She has a point.
Because you get the blunt.
It's hardest to be the oldest?
Absolutely. Your parents don't have any patience for you. You're kind of the scapegoat for everything.
And you have to be responsible for the younger
Besides
ones?
Besides, you were spoiled anyway.
How was I? I was lost
because
in the middle.
The other three picked on you. Your three older brothers picked on you.
Yeah.
And I always felt bad for you.
Well, so that's how you spoiled me. They left me at a rest stop once on vacation.
Is that
that's
true?
True. You guys
I don't
left.
Know. Did we?
You guys pulled out with six kids, and there was
Would
one
like
still
to
in
sit
the
down?
Bathroom. You were down the highway.
No baloney.
You guys were down the highway before you found out that one kid was missing. I would say two exits.
That's because you were in the bathroom.
I was in the bathroom.
Yeah, he checked every bathroom from one end to the other.
What were you looking for?
In the United States.
I don't know what she's talking about.
He was fascinated by bathrooms.
No? That's where the legend came from. All right. We're never going to agree on this. Thanks for joining, Mom. People say Audrey, my mom, has the best burns in the family. She's the best at cutting
still
people.
Still here.
Cutting people to the quick.
Well, maybe that's where you get your joke talent.
Yeah, she is funny. My mom is funny. Yes, she is.
Was there anyone else who you learned jokes from?
There was a guy in my neighborhood. He was an old man. He was like 80 years old, and we called him Jokes because he would walk around the block with his dog Ginger, and I was like 6 years old, but he would... stop, and he would tell us jokes. And they were clean. He wasn't weird or anything. It was just an old man in Chicago.
Remember an example of a joke?
No, but I remember the first joke. Cause so then we would start, like, reading. You know how, like, popsicle sticks have jokes?
Yeah.
Or, like, Dixie Riddle cups. So I just started finding, or even joke books. I would go and research a joke from a stick on a popsicle or whatever, and then I would give it back to Jokes. I would say, oh, I got one, and then I would either remember it or... I would always remember it, but my first joke was like, what do you call what's another name for a grandfather clock? An old timer. That was like one of the first jokes that I told this old man who would come around the block. And
did you get a laugh, you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Probably a cough. He was a smoker. Probably a cough and a laugh.
God, that's so funny that you know, you could trace back the start of this to some guy that walked around your block telling you jokes in a way.
Or just like I've told this before, my dad, one of seven kids, and it was neat to see, because with a big family, your parent, any parent really, they're always working. So when they were laughing at something, it was sort of a version that you didn't get to see all the time, or my mom was, you know, raising seven kids. So when you see them laughing, I want to know what makes them laugh. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was this other side of them that made me interested in comedy, too.
Like seeing them not as parents, but as people.
Yeah.
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 Did they understand that this sort of avant-garde bowling shoes wearing thing could lead somewhere?
They were always encouraging. It's like, oh, Matthew, like, why do you have to, like, do everything differently? Like, you have to do everything. Like, it was a little tiresome. Like, I'm sure I was like, come on, dude, just do it the way everybody else does it. I always probably had to do it a little different. But No, they were more like, I think they were, I remember in New York, they came to visit me when I moved to New York, and I was living with three other people in a really terrible apartment in New York when UCB just moved.
And did you have any money?
Zero. And I had, like, my brother, God bless him, wired me some money. Like, that's when I learned, like, the thing that keeps you from not being homeless is family. Like, literally stark broke, walking from, like, below Canal up to, like, 120th in New York, which is, like, a, I don't know how long it took me, 2 hour
walk.
8 miles. Yeah, whatever it is, yeah. Literally not having enough change to get in the subway and take the subway. Like, literally that money was going to be my slice of pizza for the day. Like, that poor, you know, poor planning. But also literally no, post-college, but literally no money. So my parents came to visit me early in that phase, and my dad saw, like, one of the classic New York outlets that had, like, you know, two things and literally 16 cords going into it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, everybody
Fire
in the
hazard.
House. My dad's like, this place, he was really stressed out. My mom's like, oh, my God, Matthew, please. You know, so it was stressful for them, my parents, to see me, you know, poor or not, like, at my age. I was probably 30 at the time when I moved to New York.
Did you have any notions of what life might look like if it didn't happen for you?
I had a willingness to perform and a willingness to be poor, you know, like, so I could perform. So had UCB not worked out in New York, I probably would have returned to Chicago and still performed and still done shows and written sketches and figured it out from Chicago.
Right.
I don't think I would have quit on it. I wouldn't have gone, like, legit. Like, I did legit jobs, and I hated them, and I wasn't good at
like
them.
Like what?
Well, I worked for my father's. The last legit job I had was my father's heavy machinery moving business, and I was a salesman. And so you're selling people, like, can we move your 200,000 steel furnace for you? Or, like, it's a really heavy specific, and my brothers worked for him. So I did that for, like, a year, and that was, like, the last real job I had, and I hated it. And I wasn't really good at it, and I was so glad. I got a job at Second City Touring Company. I auditioned and got in, and I'm like, that's it, I'm done. I'm out. I'm never going to have a real job, and I never had a real job again.
God, you know, it's funny, because you're talking about like that, and you've played enough characters like this to where I could see you having that job.
I could, but you're...
You have a Midwest salesman look to you.
Yeah.
And that that's not meant as an insult. You just have a very, like, I see it.
I am a generic white person. I am a generic middle-class looking dude.
Yeah.
And I've made a career in acting, putting on short sleeves and a tie.
Yeah.
And instantly, oh, yeah, that guy could manage a restaurant. Absolutely agree with you. Like, yeah. That is my first impression. Yeah, I agree with you.
My first job was as a photojournalist for the Associated Press. And I was around all kinds of sort of, you know, beaten down, cynical journalists and press liaison people in the political world. And when I first saw Veep, I was like, I was just blown away. Like, you nailed that profession. And I wondered if you based that on somebody or how you built that guy or approached him.
Well, the script as written is, I think Veep started in the era where the 24/7 news cycle was erupting. And the way it works in Chicago is like, it's relationships. It's like, you know a guy, all right, Sam, I'm gonna introduce you, but you don't meet the guy until I tell him, when you meet the guy, you tell him, you know, Walsh, and you can sit down and have a meeting. It's all about currying the relationships and controlling, like giving access to people who are in good stead with you, but it's through people,
yeah,
through human beings. And so that was my approach is like, because there's that story Obama tried to get involved in the Democratic Party in Chicago when he showed up unannounced at some alderman's office. He's like, sit down, I'm Barack Obama, I'm going to help out. Who do you know? What do you mean? Well, who sent you? Literally just to have a cold meeting, who sent you? You needed someone's blessing
right.
to have a sit down to help. Because it's almost like you're clearing, but you also want to step on toes. There's that whole network of like relationships. That's kind of how I base Mike's backstory. It's like he came up that way and he would take care of people who took care of him and he would know, like, he would make sure the New York Times got their first question or whoever did him a favor last, he would throw to them in the press room. But that doesn't matter anymore. Like, none of that matters. It's just, you can't stay ahead of the story. You can't control the story.
So he's off balance 100% of the time.
100% of the time.
And he's sad. He's a little sad.
Well, they write all these things of, like, he's got children now, and he has no money, and he had a boat, and he lied about having a dog, and he's always getting... It's a thankless job.
Yes.
You know, it's a completely thankless job.
Well, because of your improv status, does that affect your workload on Veep, or does that affect the way you interact with the other actors, or is it pretty much, is there a quality across the board?
I don't understand the question.
Let me try that again.
Yeah.
Because you are such a, you know, figure in the world of improv.
I get that part of the question.
Yeah.
I get that. I get that you're saying, like, I have status in the improv,
yes,
improv world.
That's established. That's our base reality.
Base reality is I'm a big deal in the improv world. Let's
right.
say that.
Okay. So on Veep, does that get you more involved in the writing process?
No.
And in changing it in rehearsal? Or?
Well, I have confidence, like, when we rehearse things or pitching ideas for jokes, because I have a good sense of comedy. But ultimately, pretty much everybody on the show, especially Julia, like, they write really tight scripts, and then we table read them. And then if something's not working or they want to see it on its feet, we'll go after the table read, we'll go in the stages or in the office. We'll create like a diner, and we'll move couches and create a fictional diner.
So you sort of improv it out, get
you
it
workshop
on its feet.
You workshop and you put it on its feet. And then they want input from the actors because we know the characters, and we pitch ideas about moments or scenes. And then after those rehearsals or after hearing the table read, the writers will go away and they'll rewrite it. And after multiple drafts, we'll get to filming it. And they're never like, you know, Dave's the head writer or the director. They're never like, say every word exactly the same. Like, they trust us with our ability to make a joke land or make a moment land. But we always rehearse it. And when we rehearse it, you know, we'll be like, can I come from here? Like, anything to make the bit better or discover something funny about the cup, which is not on the page, but like, can we do a bit here?
But I would think that there's also a certain decorum or code you might have to follow not to take over too much, right? Like, do you sort of have to be aware you're in this big group of people, you can't sort of throw out every idea? I mean, is that
it's an
awareness?
Ensemble. No, absolutely true. And you're also aware of, like, production again, of, like, we shoot, like, I don't know, 15 to 20 pages a day, easy. So you're like...
Really?
Yeah, I'm not going to dick around with my silly improv bits when I know
that
they
shoot 15 to 20 pages a day.
Sure.
That is a lot of... That's a lot of work.
I think so, yeah. And they write scripts that are about 60 pages long. So there's a lot to shoot. And there's, you know, little locations in every, you know, and there's like 20 actors in the ensemble, roughly, or 15. So you know, if you're a sensible person and you're like, well, I'm not going to fuck around and try to like make it about me or this moment. Like, we have a lot of things to shoot. So you just try to execute what's on the page and give them the best version of that. But you can always pitch jokes or ask for, can I get a better joke here? Like, the writers are on set. So it's very informal and fluid. It's not like rigid, like say it as it's written. It's never like,
right.
But in truth, I'll say like, if there's a 3-page scene and I'm in the scene and I don't say anything, I'll say like, can I just say something in this scene?
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I have that, but I don't have like, I need to be much more funny or whatever.
No, but I think yours is an example, obviously, of a show working great. And it brings up a question about what you think is the thing that's the hardest about that show that gets totally taken for granted by an audience.
I think what is unique about it is we messy it up or zhuzh it up. I think Julia says zhuzh sometimes. But we try to make it sloppy, overlappy, dirty, clumsy feeling, but it's so intentional. It's so intentional. Like, it's documentary style, so the cameras are always moving.
Right.
Like, we talk over each other. Our vernacular is very informal and filthy. Like, obviously, we're super vulgar. But so much thought goes into making it feel completely, like, clumsy and dirty and sloppy. You know, it's not like people doing brilliant, eloquent, well-spoken, distinctive monologues on the show. It's just like, what? Who? Get him in here. No, put it down. It has that energy and sloppiness, but it's all intentional. So I think that's what I like about the show, is it seems sort of like sloppy and unimpressive, like intentionally like dirty or clumsy.
Right.
But it's all performers-wise, like, you know, for the performers, we want that. We want it to be in that way, like real and alive and sloppy and dirty.
What's it like having a steady job for this long after the life you've led?
It's the best. I was one and done forever, meaning like a pilot or one season and then never again. So it's a real, I'm very grateful to have a character to return to multiple seasons, because you only get better as an actor to understand it. And also the ensemble gets better. And also grateful as a father of kids that I know I have a job coming back in the fall.
Was that before Veep? Was that part of the deal? Was you're just, there's some stress and anxiety involved with just wondering if you're going to work, even though you've sort of set UCB in motion?
I feel like my first year, when my son Jude was born, that first year of his life, I feel like I never had a job. Like somehow we survived, me and Morgan, we were able to pay our bills and everything. But literally it was one of the most financially stressful years of my life because we had a kid. And the good news was I was around to help Morgan a little bit, you know, with him. And get to see my son grow from 0 days to, you know, his first year of his life was beautiful, but so stressful. So stressful. Like, God, what can I do? I got to write something. I got to book something, you know.
God, he's 9, so that was only 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that's a misconception for people, you know, that you're running theaters and you're creating, you know, this sort of cottage industry of improv that hadn't existed before and all this stuff, but you're still struggling up until fairly recently. And I just see a guy who's, you know, would rather spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money on an improv film or try to do interesting work than find something steady. It's pretty great, you know, that, and it speaks to you staying young and it speaks to you wanting to be experimental and challenge yourself. And I admire that.
Well, thank you. I think it's the game for all actors, too. Like, you don't know how long this gig's going to last.
Yeah.
You know, and when you get into a good one and it comes back. Because I've done a lot of good, I'm proud of many of the things I've been in, but they're either movie or TV show or pilot. So I've been lucky to work with really funny people. But when one comes back again and again, like Veep, it's so, and everyone's super friendly and super cool and funny. It's rare. It's so rare.
Do you still have that message in your mind of, well, I can always go back to doing shows in the theater? You know what I mean? Like,
they don't make any money, but yeah, I'll always do live shows. I love doing live shows.
Yeah.
Improvisers don't make any money unless you teach it, which UCB does.
Right.
If you want to make money as an improviser, teach it or start your own theater. Absolutely true.
Yeah.
But as an improviser, you're never going to make money unless you like get a sitcom or get a turn it into stand-up material or use your improv shows to like write. Like when we did UCB, we would tape our improv shows. And then from those improv shows, we would look for scene ideas for sketches to write. So you
can perform as a showcase to get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we would tape it and then one of us would look at the tapes and say, oh, that was a funny scene. I'm going to write it up, you know. So you can use it for that to generate material. But I do love improv because it's the lazy man's art form. It's like you don't have to rehearse. You can just show up. You work with people that are more talented than you, and you all come off great.
Well, that's a very humble way to look at it. I mean, I delve into this a little bit, and I go, you know, it's the most challenging, high-wire, no-net form of art, and you're obviously not lazy.
Yeah, I'm not truly lazy.
Yeah.
No. But it is, you're right. I mean, to be good at it or to be seamless at it, the people you watch, they're doing so many things. They're editing, they're writing on your feet, you're writing things on your feet, you're being asked to embody multiple characters, or you could play a chair. Somebody will sit on your back in a scene. You never know what you're going to have to be in an improv scene. So, yeah. You have to be versatile and smart and fast and good listener and director, writer. All that comes into play. Yes, that's true.
Well, listen, you're all those things, and I love the work you're doing. And thanks for being so honest about it and telling me, you know, you're making me want to go sign up for a class.
This is good. Do it. Do it. Or don't. You have a good gig. You don't need that.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just improv with you here.
Yeah.
So that's segment one.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
No worries.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed Matt Walsh and his mom as much as I did. And if you haven't yet checked out Veep, go to HBO and watch it and start from the beginning. It is one of the most well-written, smart, funny, and surprising shows that I've seen in a long time. So check that out. And while you're at it, check out offcamera.com. If you're a regular listener to this show, I know you hear me talk about the off-camera site a lot. But the truth is, it's really the heart and soul of off-camera because at the website, you can do a lot of things. You can subscribe to the website and get updates from us weekly. You can see full-length director's cuts of all our shows. You can get our app, and you can go to our store and get our magazine. We make a limited edition magazine for every guest that comes on the show. And with a magazine subscription, you can get off-camera delivered right to your door. It's a cool addendum to the show because there's exclusive photographs and a lot of information about each guest that isn't in the podcast or the television show. And best of all, you're supporting off-camera and keeping your coffee table interesting. So check that out. If you want to drop us a line, I'm sam@offcamera.com. And on social media, we are Off-Camera Show at Twitter, Off-Camera Show at Instagram, and I'm Sam Jones at Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures at Instagram. So there you go. That's how to get in touch with us. I want to say a quick thank you to everyone that works on the show and helps us out. Crawford Shippey, Michaela Galvin, Laura Kemper, Nathan Shields, Amy Jones, Kara Johnson, Justin Kennedy, Matt Davidson, Vin Scully. Okay, Vin Scully doesn't really help us out, but he is an inspiration. And speaking of inspirations, I want to talk about next week when you're going to hear a very special podcast. Yep, it's our 100th episode. And I can't think of a better guest to celebrate the occasion than a guy who hit his 100th episode at age 10. And only 10 years later, he was well on his way to becoming one of our best known and most successful filmmakers.
I became an actor as a child, but I don't quite have an actor's mentality. I had a lot more creative potential as a director. And, you know, I think one of the things that was a huge benefit was that I always enjoyed it. And I just have never taken that for granted. I don't to this day. I get excited when I show up on the set. Even if I know it's going to be a tough day of shooting, I still, as the car is pulling up, I get a kind of surge of, all right, let's see what we can do. Let's see, we have these resources. We have these people. We have this story. We have this opportunity. What can we do?
I sit down with director Ron Howard to discuss a career that spanned two golden ages of television. We talk about his transition from acting to directing, working with some of our best-known actors, and, surprisingly, the importance of accepting failure. He also explains how a 17-hour vomit-soaked plane ride led to the most important film of his career. When one of cinema's finest storytellers shares his own story, you know it's going to be good. So join me for our 100th episode of Off Camera. Thanks for being a part of this, and I'll see you next time, off camera.